When are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome back to Hopping Mad. I am Will McLeod.
And I'm Arliss Bunny.
And we are so glad to be back after our long hiatus.
It's not like anything's happened while we were away.
I mean, yeah, I'm glad that in the last, month or so that Trump hasn't tweeted anything or done anything or decided that he wants tanks rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue in a city where the infrastructure's not able to support them and you'd end up with a battalion of tanks in the metro. I'm glad none of that happened.
And the State of the Union happened, but I'm terribly glad we were able to avoid shutdowns. Oh, no,
yeah.
Wait. Times two. So it's been a little crazy. You'll notice right now that the sound of the show is really different than normal. And for one reason, on my part, it's because I'm still traveling and I scrambled out last night to basically Best Buy and bought a new headset, a Logitech headset with a mic on it. So that's why my side sounds weird.
And I've moved to Richmond where the rent is much lower than DC. And I live in basically, you could have a church service in here. It's that like big. I'm stunned and I'm paying way less. I love Richmond. It's amazing. But you'll be able to hear some echoes on this end.
So we'll work on that over time and work on helping Will with the echoes situation. But today on Hopping Mad, I'm going to talk about the weird that is the latest going on with Northern Ireland and Brexit, and I'm going to get to what the heck is going on with the stock market.
And I will be talking about November and our chances there and what we need to do to win, and also the new and yet old coalition government between the SPD and the Christian Democrats in Germany.
But first,
Let's talk about November. So a new poll came out today, and it's February 9th when we're recording this, that puts the Democrats 11 points ahead. That's a Marist College poll. And things are continuing to look up for us. We've won some state seats that were red that we shouldn't have won. We have a great slate of candidates coming up, and we're going to try to have some interviews with those folks coming up, including a friend of mine.
Watch out when you say that we shouldn't have won, because we should have won that seat in Missouri. People worked their asses off to win that seat. The point is, we weren't expected to win. We weren't expected to pick up 20 points, 30 points, that kind of thing, in Missouri, of all places.
Yeah. In that, with the good polling, with the amazing results because of all the hard work that local Democrats and the resistance are doing, with all of that that's happening, I'm starting to get the same kind of feeling I had at the end of 2016. And that feeling is, you know, with some of the folks I talk to and some of the folks I work with, there were some Democrats that thought that as far as 2016 was concerned, we could just sit around refreshing 538 and sipping white wine and then Hillary would win. And that's not true. When we think we're going to win, when we feel good about our chances, we tend to celebrate in the end zone without actually winning the election, and then we lose the election because we didn't do the work we needed to win. We are winning these races in deep red areas because of how hard we are working. If we can keep up our efforts, if we can keep working extremely hard to defeat this agenda and to defeat this president and to take Congress back, we can win both the House and the Senate. But it is still not something we are expected to win due to gerrymandering. I mean, we've got a massive point spread that we need to come up with to conquer gerrymandering. I mean, I think in order to win the House, we've got to carry the generic congressional ballot by 9 points. We're only at 11. that's still too close to call to decide whether or not we're going to be able to take Congress. And every single one of these races is local, so we've got to work really, really hard on that front. Just because a lot of the fundamentals of these races look good for us doesn't mean we're guaranteed victory. And I know there are a lot of very tired Democrats out there who have been working very, very hard, who are like, yeah, we know, we've been doing that work. You folks are awesome. I'm mostly speaking to a lot of folks who kind of feel like me and live in more of the left-wing territory. We've got to get out there. We've got to drive out and do door knocks. We've got to work hard.
Well, and also, I listen to the Rational Security podcast, which is excellent, by the way. But one of the things that they were saying at one point in time is that Trump is absolutely causing us to lose tremendous ground internationally. Yeah. And the entire world is watching 2018. And if American voters hand Trump a huge defeat, a huge rebuke, then there is some hope that if we throw him out of office in 2020, we will be basically more welcome back on the international stage again. But the size of the rebuke matters. It's not just that we need to win. We need to win big.
Or potentially throw him out sooner. I don't Mike Pence. Mike Pence is awful, but I don't think that Mike Pence is going to nuke Pyongyang because he thinks it might, you know, help conservatives win an election. I would rather have Mike Pence, as much as I despise that man, I would rather have him in control of the military than Donald Trump, because I think he's evil and I think he's wrong and I think he's awful, but I don't think he's crazy enough to start a war.
Yeah, no, I don't think he's insane, and I don't think he has basically dementia. I do. I am entertained by the parade.
Can we talk about that for a second?
I mean, not only is it like the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Can you imagine what they're doing over at the Pentagon? They're just, these are people who are just beating their heads against the table at this point in time.
And let me just say this. I don't know if any of you, dear listeners, except for those who have been in the military, have heard what an M1 Abrams tank sounds like. It has a gas turbine engine in it, which is basically the equivalent of a jet engine, but for ground vehicles.
Yeah,
if you try to put those in the concrete canyon that is DC, you're going to deafen the audience.
And it's going to tear up the pavement. I mean, they're going to have to completely, it's not, well, fortunately, it's not like there's ever traffic on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Ever. Like, it's that never happens. You know, DC isn't known at all for its bad traffic or anything. But I'm not worried about the pavement. I'm worried about the sewer. I mean, if you try to drive a tank battalion down Pennsylvania Avenue, it's going to sink into the ground. I mean, I talked to one of the guys who has done the sewer management, and there are areas of DC that still have wooden pipes.
Oh, nice.
Because Congress has never properly funded DC infrastructure. We have a website for DC residents to let us know if we need to take an Uber called Is Metro on Fire Right Now? And if the answer is that it is not currently on fire right now, it says not yet, because it will at some point in the future be on fire again.
Lovely.
That is our infrastructure in the District of Columbia. And, you know, maybe it would be a good thing to have a tank battalion fall into the metro because, you know, it would force Congress to actually pay for DC infrastructure. But I fear that instead of, you know, spending on DC infrastructure, they'll just take all of the money away from DC schools to do it.
Oh, I'm sure.
So they're not going to let us be a state and fund our own way. I say us because I lived there very recently and I don't anymore. But they're not going to let D.C. be a state and pay their own way, even though they could afford to do that.
Right.
They want to control the purse strings and all of that. But, I mean, and to top it all off, they're talking about having the military go through all of this massive effort to have a parade in order to salute the military. How about instead of saluting the military by forcing them to march around in front of Trump, how about we make sure that no vets go homeless and that no military families are in public assistance.
Yes, how about we just pay them more? I think they would feel saluted if we paid them more.
Yeah, I mean, if Trump wants a military parade, he can just go stand outside of a VA and watch the line move by. That's...
There you go. So speaking of lines, I'm thinking about borders, and I'm going to...
Awesome segue.
I'm going to segue right to what's going on with Northern Ireland. I had a whole different segment prepared for the top of the show, and I will talk about David Dayan next week, but because something terrible happened to him, and I'll fill you in on all of that next week. But last night, flashing up on my laptop, was this notification about the EU and Brexit and Northern Ireland. So I click on the little link and I go to see the Guardian story that had just been posted. And here's a summary of that story. EU Brexit negotiators have announced that in their coming draft of the Brexit agreement, they are stipulating that Northern Ireland is to remain in the customs union and the single market after Brexit. It comes down to being exactly what Will and I have been talking about for the last year on this subject, that if you put a hard border back in Ireland between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, that will be in breach of the Good Friday Agreement. And that's the end of peace in Northern Ireland. You can just write that baby off. So because the Republic isn't interested in fueling the fire, and because the EU isn't interested in having an internecine war going on in anywhere in Europe, they are trying to shut that down. So, for instance, the chief constable of the police service in Northern Ireland, and I don't know that this position has ever been filled by a Republican. It is always filled by somebody, by an Orangeman, basically. But the chief constable of the police service in Northern Ireland has said that closing the border, even with the lightest touch, will be a target for armed groups and put people in danger. Quote, the terrorists only have to be lucky once and get a result with catastrophic consequences. Close quote. So this guy is speaking the absolute truth. He's speaking truth to power.
Yeah.
The Northern Ireland will, in the case of applicable trade law, according to the EU, remain under the EU, thereby avoiding this all-out breach with the Good Friday Agreement. And but what they've said about this is, and this is a quote from an EU negotiator, this might cause some problems in the UK, but we didn't create this mess. Close quote.
Oh.
I just love it. Them giving it back to the May government exactly the way it is.
I mean, speaking of someone who supports a United Ireland and an independent Scotland, that gives me a Schadenfreude-gasm.
Yes.
Right there. Imagining the faces on May's negotiating team when that was said.
Yeah, they've just got to be seriously unhappy. The May government has been preaching basically these mutually exclusive principles. They keep talking about Brexit, and then they talk about something that they're calling frictionless trade for Northern Ireland with absolutely no explanation as to what frictionless trade is or how it would work. Because what frictionless trade is a common market.
Yeah, well, and there's a really easy way to explain that based on May's other statements. This is the blue part of the red, white, and blue Brexit she was talking about. This is the bluer section of that. The May government has no idea what they're talking about.
And they have not come to terms with the fact that these things are mutually exclusive. And this is a quote from the Guardian piece. The UK government has said that in the absence of agreed solutions, the United Kingdom will maintain full alignment with those rules of the internal market and the customs union, which now or in the future support North and South cooperation, the all-island economy, and the protection of the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. Despite initial protests from the DUP, the unionists were bought off with paragraph 50 of the joint agreement, in which British government promised to ensure that there would be no barriers to trade between the British mainland and Northern Ireland. That's all very well and good. But John McGrane, the Director General of the British-Irish Chamber of Commerce, has said that there was still this delusional sense within some government departments in the UK that it would be sorted out, somehow magically sorted out. He claimed that there's this, and this is what I think is really interesting. He talks about there being this underlying sense of entitlement that Britain could carry on as it was because it's so important.
That is the problem yes. with the UK, right there. You have a group of people who still think they're the British Empire. You have this incredible arrogance in London where they think that they still run the entire world, and they operate as if everybody in the world must come to them and that they do not have any responsibility to meet the rest of the world where it is. And they're about to get a very, very hard lesson in the fact that the British nation, that the United Kingdom, is now a regional power that has less influence than France or Germany.
Yeah, it's sitting on a tiny island, basically.
Yeah. I mean, they act as if they're still an empire and act as if they want to be a tiny island off the coast of Maryland when, in fact, they're a tiny island off the coast of Europe. And you hear about this problem from people who live in the UK, where people who live within that M25 beltway are arrogant enough to think that they can dictate to everybody who lives outside of it. And they're going to get a really hard wake up here. And so what this means, what it sounds like, and this is my question for you, Arliss, is it sounds like they're going to have to accept the single market, which means they're going to have to accept free movement of people, which means that if Brexit goes forward, all they're going to get to do is lose their say about anything the EU does and lose their veto power. That seems like all that's going to change here.
I think there's going to be a, I think that the EU won't allow that to happen because they're pissed, among other things. They're mad. I think the EU is looking to punish the Brits a bit, but at the same time, they also want to avoid war. I do think that, and you and I were talking about this prior to the start of the show, but I do think that if this agreement is formatted in this way, that it bodes well for Scotland.
Yes. Yes, because if it is true that one part of the UK can stay within the customs union and keep their EU citizenship, then there is no legal barrier to another part of the UK doing exactly the same thing, which means the Scots are going to be saying, if you decide we don't get to have the single market and free movement and the customs union and EU citizenship and all these other things we very badly want, then you're just doing it to spite us, not because there's actually an impossibility here.
Right.
So this is kind of seems to be a gift to Scotland as well with the way that they're structuring this, because Guy Verhofstadt stood in the European Parliament and said, we've got to do something for Scotland. And this seems like it may be the beginnings of that.
Maybe, I don't know. Being hopeful, but
yes.
You know, let's be hopeful for a moment. There is cause in general to be hopeful, and next up on Hopping Mad, Will is going to talk about what's going on in Germany.
We're back on Hopping Mad. So, about 4 months or so ago, I did a piece on Germany and how they'd had this election and the basically Nazis of Alternative for Deutschland won some seats. And they were going to go into negotiations and Merkel was going to try to find some variety of coalition. In the run-up to the election that led to the current makeup of the German government, the two major parties, the CDU, Christian Democratic Union, and the SPD, the Social Democratic Party, had announced that they would not go back into coalition. They had been in coalition for a long time as part of this grand coalition, so that the center-left SPD and center-right CDU would have to work together. And they felt that that had eroded their distinctiveness and left the voters feeling apathetic about both parties, and that they really needed to draw a distinction between each other. But it looks like, despite all of that, after 4 months of negotiation, they're going to go back into coalition, which is what they said would not happen. This is being called by some commenters the first SPD government with a CDU chancellor, because the SPD is going to be given basically most of the cabinet positions. The CDU is only going to keep four major cabinet positions, including economy, defense, health, education, and agriculture. That's five.
Wait, what you're telling me is that by holding out, the SPD got what they wanted.
Yeah, they got control of the finance.
Democrats, take note.
Yes, hold out and you get what you want. So their leader, Martin Schulz, is pretty optimistic about things going forward. And so is the rest of Europe. They're hinting that there's going to be a relaxing of forced austerity, because the previous finance minister was an absolute deficit hawk. And he's being replaced by a guy named Olaf Scholz. And the SPD in general is not a pro-austerity party, but Scholz apparently comes from the more conservative side of the SPD. He is a centrist. And to my dismay, I was thinking, oh, this is the end of austerity in Europe, but doesn't look that way, because Scholz is being praised by the opinion section of the Financial Times today. So that's a bad sign, because while the Financial Times is excellent in their reporting, their opinion pages are a neoliberal cesspit. And he's being praised as a responsible leader that isn't going to turn on the money taps. It's a quote from a Jens Zimmermann. He won't go around Europe lecturing people the way Schäuble did, but that doesn't mean Germany will suddenly turn on the money taps. He says that he said that Olaf Scholz is like a Hanseatic merchant, reliable, solid, the opposite of former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis. He's very German. He won't do anything crazy. And maybe that's...
And sadly, Varoufakis' version of crazy might actually have caused Europe to thrive much sooner and to a much greater degree than it currently is. But let's just move on.
Yeah, I mean, the hope is, my hope, and let's be hopeful here, is that Scholz is going to step away from this forced austerity policy. The SPD has hinted that they would be happy to contribute more German money to the ECB and to EU finances.
Well, and Scholz certainly is to the left of Schäuble. There's no question that he's to the left of Schäuble.
Schäuble, as far as economics is concerned, is so far to the right and so hawkish that I mean, it's hard to find people more conservative than Schäuble.
Yeah, well, there is that.
I mean, there's a good chance that most Republicans are to the left of Schäuble economically.
Yeah, well,
I mean, Schäuble pinched the German coinage so hard they would scream. He was so tight-fisted with German money because, as we're about to talk about when it comes to inflation.
Schäuble was happy to see Greeks die, literally die, in order to save money in Germany.
Yeah, he values money more than he does human life. That is the fact about Schäuble. So absolutely, Scholz as a centrist is going to be much better, but not going to be an MMT paradise. We're not going to see the sorts of developments we want. I think the best way to describe this is that it's going to be a lot less terrible.
Well, and I think that Scholz is probably going to be more negotiable. In other words, it will be easier to move him off of center than it ever was to move Schäuble an inch.
Yeah, This despite Schultz's reputation as an extremely tough negotiator, he is still willing to negotiate, whereas Schäuble was, you know, you're going to do what I tell you, and there is no negotiation. At least there will be an actual negotiation with Schultz. At least you can say that much. Now, the CDU is very unhappy with the fact that the SPD is taking over so many of these important government roles. So they're unhappy, but there's also another hurdle to get over, which is according to SPD party rules, they have to now have a postal vote among their members to see if they'll accept the coalition. But Schultz, the current leader of the SPD, is hopeful that he can get that, but it's not a done deal yet. So we'll know if this goes through in about 4 weeks. And interestingly enough, there's been a big movement among the left in Germany under the banner Join and Say No for people to join the SPD so they can vote against a new coalition, because a lot of folks on the left don't like this and aren't happy. And a lot of the folks on the right don't like this or aren't happy. And I understand all the reasons why, because I would not want a coalition between Nancy Pelosi and Paul Ryan. I would hate that. But under the German sort of parliamentary chancellery system, I'm not sure what other option there is under the current politics and structure of the German government other than this. Yep. I mean, I think this is what there is. And so if the...
Well, it is what parliament means, basically.
Yeah. I mean, and if the SPD party membership says no, I'm not sure what happens at that point. I mean, would they declare a hung Reichstag and hold another election? Is that even possible under the current formulation? Would there be a minority CDU government with some kind of confidence in supply arrangement with the SPD? Would there be another election? And how would the people of Germany feel about that? I have no idea what happens at that stage.
And this all matters to us here, because I suspect there are folks out here saying, well, this is all very interesting, but it doesn't really affect me on a day-to-day basis. But it does actually matter to us, because right now in the world in general, in the international sort of venue in general, the Germans they're the grown-ups. They are, Angela Merkel is leading the West.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have handed over leadership of the West to Merkel. And anything that destabilizes the German government is not handy right now. It is not helpful. We need them to be secure and thriving and moving along and with confident leadership. This does not help.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and if you look at the current EU negotiations with Britain, the Germans have a major role in that. If you look at the functioning of the EU itself as the largest economic bloc on the planet, this Germany needs to be stable. They are a major international power in a way that a lot of us just don't recognize, especially in the age of Trump. I mean, Germany is basically a linchpin at this point that is keeping the West stable. And so that really should not fall apart for the rest of our six. So you can bet that the Russians are going to be throwing their weight around in Germany as well.
Oh, yeah.
Just like news coming out that they're throwing away their weight around in the midterms, but that's another story. So I hope that this goes through. I hope that we have stability in Germany, and I hope that Olaf Scholz will be a new wind that helps sweep the forced austerity away in the EU, even though I know it's not going to be that big of a change. It's a baby step in the right direction, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I hope this goes through, because I think it's good for Europe. I think it's good for Germany. And I think it's good for the rest of us, but it all comes down to those SPD voters. Coming up, we are going to be talking about the stock market and inflation a little bit here on Hopping Mad. It's an interesting section. Stay tuned.
So we're back on Hopping Mad, and today I'm talking to you about what is going on with the stock market, or as I've been calling it, the Trump slump.
Real quick, I want to make sure that I understand this. So the stock market is the same thing as the economy, right?
Not even a little bit. And we're going to talk, I'm going to get to that in some detail, because I think that's one of the big disconnects. When people see the stock market fall, they start to panic because they think that the economy is falling. These are different things. And so the first thing is that with this Trump slump, who cares, right? Who does this matter to in its current form? And it may, this slump may end up mattering a great deal to investment banks and commercial banks who are, once again, in many cases, over-leveraged. It may end up mattering to people who are retired or planning to retire very soon and are living off of their investment income. It matters much less to those of us who have very little invested in anything beyond our homes, and it is in this way not a lot, it is not yet like the 2007 global financial crisis. And one more step down, it matters even less to those who are not homeowners and do not have investments. So this is the kind of market slump which, at for the moment, is hitting hardest at the top, which, in my opinion, by the by, is where it should hit. He who gambles should be he who pays. Any associated losses. That's
agreed.
Not
Can I just say that I'm still angry that the banks ran out of our money and we gave them more money?
That's exactly where I was going. It's when you and I were absolutely in concert on that comment. You have to love the fact, and I swear this made my whole week, and I've just been glowing about it all week. You have to love the fact that this is happening immediately after the State of the Union, in which Trump bragged about record market highs. So I love, love, love that he's getting the Trump slump slap in the face right now, right on the heels of the State of the Union. The potentially dangerous thing is that if losses continue and failure to rebound, the thing that happened in 2007 was that bank liquidity dried up, and that could hurt all of us a lot should this extend. And we simply don't know if that will be the case. The real problem is that if this starts to look like it's going to be an extended problem, the recovery for all of this will be in the hands of the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are pros you want to trust with your entire economy.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I'm really not feeling any anxiety about the economy now.
Yeah.
But you said this.
So what are the Wall Street quaking aspen neoliberals saying about why they care? And I call them quaking aspens because quaking aspens are all joined together. Their root systems are all they are actually a single organism. A grove of quaking aspens is a single organism. And they make this shaking, kind of tinkling sound when the wind is blowing through their leaves all together. And to me, that is how Wall Street is behaving, and in fact frequently behaves. They're saying that this is about inflation, and I'll talk about inflation in just a minute, but more likely, in my opinion, this is a reality check, because they have been riding an unrealistic market wave, a bubble, well beyond its natural crest. Part of that has to do with the tax cut to the most wealthy. It has to do with a lot of things. And I really think, let me go back for a moment. The stock market does not reflect the real economy at all. Not at all. And this is a mistake we just make all the time. We think of a rise in the market as an indicator of new investment and economic growth, right? That's how we think of it. But what we learned in 2007 really plainly was that the market of that time really reflected just wild betting on fraudulent investments with zero actual growth in the real economy underneath. In fact, the real economy was not only shrinking, but it had been shrinking for some time. And frankly, almost any Trump voter could have told Wall Street that if Wall Street had asked them. They could have come out of their, you know, trailer in the middle of Arkansas and explained to Wall Street that the economy was shrinking. They knew, and that's why Trump is sitting in the White House right now. The stock market is a rentier playground. It is entirely dominated by those who own for a living, not those who work for a living. Prior to the dot-com bubble bursting, the middle class was investing in the stock market, but they didn't return to that. After they lost so much, after the middle class lost so much in the dot-com crash, they didn't come back to Wall Street. Wall Street really is just the top, the most wealthy members of our economy placing side bets, gambling on our economy. And when you look, when they're reporting out numbers from corporate quarterly earnings, the most reported information, which even slightly, possibly, faintly indicates real economic fundamentals, is going to be growth in earnings. Earnings per share is only a measure of rentier gaming gains or losses. It has nothing to do with the underlying fundamentals of how healthy a corporation is. So let me go back a little bit and talk about what the stock market really is. And I'm going to start by talking about what it's not. And it is not a means by which individuals or groups invest in companies and therefore drive the economy forward by financing new or more efficient production of goods or services. It is not that. When you hear me or, frankly, any MMT wonk talk about the real economy, we are talking about real companies, real products, real services, real jobs. The only time a company receives new investment from the stock market as a result of entering the market, when it comes into the market in the first place and there's an initial public offering, an IPO, or if it does something like a stock split, then the company is picking up money to itself. In the current economy, many large companies are sitting on piles of money and they're not really doing anything with those piles of money. Most companies could be investing in real economic growth, but frankly, they're limited by their stockholders. And this is when it gets ugly. Since the 1970s, when corporations shifted from being focused on profitable, long-term survival, they shifted from that to maximizing shareholder profits. Publicly held corporations stopped being organisms which were functioning in their own best interest. I'll say that again so that I'm really clear. When they started focusing on maximizing shareholder profits, then the only thing corporations were worrying about was quarterly earnings for shareholders, which means that all kinds of other things suffer. And when you see the sluggish nature of the U.S. economy, you understand that that really is the case. Stockholders are economic parasites. Virtually all trading on the stock market is between people and organizations, and when I say that, I mean actually gamblers, who are making side bets on the success of a given company or investment vehicle. And when I say side bet, I mean that they're not investing in the company. They're making side bets between themselves. As in, you go to the racetrack and instead of betting at the window on the horses, you bet with the guy sitting next to you. So the company only receives benefits from these side bets based on how much of its own stock it holds. And even money made from these side bets, which are held by the company itself, almost never gets invested back into the working capital of corporations. In most cases, and you know this when you think about it, it's logical when you think about it, in most cases, companies are passing large portions of these benefits along to their top executives and board members personally. And these funds are therefore siphoned out of the company and into personal bank accounts. So focusing on shareholder profits means that instead of profits going back to working capital, profits are going to individuals who sit on the board and in top management. And that is the problem with American corporations. The bulk of the side bet money, basically the stock market, simply moves back and forth between various gamblers. This, therefore, is money which is not actively working in the real economy. And this is why the stock market is not reflective of what's going on in the real economy. Money invested in side bets is money which is essentially null to the economy. And just in case you're wondering, and this is when I go back to the dot-com crash, the middle class, except in some very basically minor ways, is not invested. This really is all happening in the top, 1% of our economy, maybe the top, of earners in our economy. Being publicly held does indeed cause companies to be less successful and probably less profitable over the long run. The focus is on gamblers and short-term gain, and companies need to be free to invest in long horizon R&D projects, invest in employees, invest in capital equipment or physical plants, all those kinds of things that help companies plan for the future. And in fact, they need to be able to be nimble and change direction without fear of investor backlash. You hear in the news about investor backlash, and that is gamblers telling corporate executives how to run their company.
You know, I'm not surprised that rampant speculation doesn't do anything for the economy, but I really wish we could have a longer and bigger national conversation off of podcasts like this one and throughout the American economy about how speculation is bad, because yeah. These gamblers have been really disastrously wrong about pretty much everything.
Over and over and over again.
Since they took over the economy. And it got to the point that, I made this quote earlier, the banks ran out of our money. These people aren't gambling largely with their own money. They're gambling with other people's money.
Exactly.
They're not going to be hurt when things collapse. And if things collapse bad enough, if they damage things bad enough that the whole economy falls apart, they really are expecting the rest of us to take our money and give it to them. They're gambling with our economy, our money, and our future and reaping all of the benefits. I would be totally fine if the stock market worked the way it used to, where this was about investing in a company you believed in rather than about the gamblers running the asylum.
Right.
But that's not the economy we have right now, or not the stock market we have right now.
Right.
I think about all these publicly traded companies, and I think about comparing them to a company like Publix that's worker-owned. Publix supermarkets, for anyone that's not in the Southeast, is a worker-owned supermarket that is amazing and clean, and they were set up by a guy who understood logistics because of the various work that he'd done. And as far as I know, they have never had to close a store.
Well, and think about this. Koch Brothers privately, or Koch Industries privately held.
Yeah.
Bechtel privately held. Privately held corporations are able to make decisions in their own best interests without worrying about anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Privately held or worker held or any kind of company that doesn't expose itself to stock market nonsense is able to make decisions in its own best interest. I mean, that's why these companies keep collapsing, and that's why these companies keep making poor decisions, is because of investor backlash. I mean, if you have a bunch of people who are educated about how to run a company and who understand this stuff, they're not going to make decisions that only work for the next quarter unless they're forced to.
Right, right.
And that's the situation we're in.
So the big question then is, and I was asked this by somebody online, so that's in fact why I'm talking about this today, why has the market been going up so much? Why, what's been going on during the last year before the Trump slump? Why was the market going up so much? Well, first of all, these guys making side bets, these gamblers, were excited about the deregulation of everything from the decimation of clean air and water standards, to reduced enforcement from OSHA, to backing down on labor law implementation and enforcement. All of those things are telescoping down to, you know, or they're telescoping down or going away. And even more exciting to these gambler investors was the impending end of Dodd-Frank. And frankly, tied tightly to that, the backing down of enforcement from every regulatory authority with even a passing acquaintance with Wall Street. And that, in fact, is part of what I'm going to talk about next week when I'm talking about what's going on with David Dayen. And then this $1 trillion tax cut that's just been given to the top 1% will almost all go into the market over time, fueling a demand imbalance, right? Because they're going to dump this money because they don't need it for anything else, right? The top 1% of this company, they don't need any more money. So if you give them more money, they're just looking for places to park it. And they're going to park a good percentage of that in the stock market. And that will create a demand imbalance. And what is that? A demand imbalance in the stock market is also called a
bubble.
There you go. So even if we're able to recover from this Trump slump, there'll be another bubble, and there will be another correction, as they say it in stock market ease. So,
can I ask a question real quick? How long can these bubbles go on, and the boom and bust of bubbles go on, while we ignore the real economy? I mean, how long can this last before an even larger correction takes place? Because as I understand it, most of our economy is driven by consumer spending. The less consumers have to spend, the worse off the economy is. What I don't understand about Democrats is we could really make a case for these folks by saying, hey, we're trying to give your customers more money. Stop complaining. But we don't make that case. But in absence of us, you know, making sure that consumers have money to spend and that everybody can afford the things they need, how long can the speculation go on before there's a massive correction?
Well, they're going to keep being, you know, Minsky moments, basically. And I'll talk a little bit more about that next week, but there will keep being boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust. It is the cycle. And, you know, so part of the answer is how long you got. But the fact is that at some point in time, it will, you know, after the global financial crisis, Dodd-Frank came into being. And we got it a little bit right and a lot wrong. I suspect that after the next big crash, we would get it a little bit more right. That's how democracy works. Sadly, we have to be hit over the head repeatedly before ever managing to learn anything. But we only move forward if people who are willing to learn something are in positions of power. And since Democrats have forfeited our ways of leveraging power, we're stuck right now. So with everything, and you know, this has been our problem, with everything moving in favor of the top 1%, and since they own virtually all of the stock market, the question then is, why is there this Trump slump? What's caused this? Well, they're saying it's because they're afraid of inflation. And frankly, this can't be true unless they're really, really stupid. Oh, wait. Okay, I'll rephrase. They believe there's a monster under their bed, and they, like the president, are basically five-year-olds. And I love something that happened on Twitter this week. And here I think,
real quick,
yeah,
I know a lot of five-year-olds who, if they stick their hand in a fire and burn themselves, aren't going to stick their hand in the fire anymore.
Again, yeah, exactly. You're, oh, so correct. So Stephanie Kelton and I really have to thank her for this because she retweeted Mark Blythe, and I had missed this, his tweet. He's the political economy prof at Brown, and he's the guy who wrote Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea, and long-term listeners will recall that I've talked about this book in the past. But what she's saying was that even if inflation was the problem, and she doesn't think it is, but even if inflation was the problem, Blythe's tweet is the perfect retort to those who do think this is the problem. And this is what Blythe said, quote, "Thought for the day. Let's say rising wages cause inflation. Panic causes equity crash. So we have built a system where stability is a function of wage stagnation, and growth can only happen in assets, never in wages. Yeah, that'll work for most people," close quote. For those who really do, and there are a lot of people out there, who think an upwards pressure on wages will drive inflation into unacceptably high levels, there's this. Inflation is not the result of higher wages. Inflation is caused only when demand exceeds supply broadly across the economy month over month. In other words, it's not a correction, it's a month over month characteristic. Companies have to having to pay more for engineers, doctors, stockbrokers is not enough. An adjustment as companies bring wages up to attempt to make up for wages being suppressed during the global financial crisis is also not inflation. On top of all of that, there is this most obvious point. We have not reached full employment until the 11 million people who no longer count against employment numbers because they're underemployed or have been unemployed for so long that they've fallen out of the rolls of those who quote-unquote count are employed fully. So there are 11 million people who are not even counted as unemployed who are actually unemployed. And even if, we were at full employment, there are easy ways to roll back wage pressure if it truly becomes an issue. First of all, you start by offering citizenship to those who live here but currently can't legally work. Huh, what a concept.
Can I ask a quick question about this, the concept of labor and inflation? So one of the quotes that I heard in college when studying this that I like is blaming labor for inflation is a bit like blaming hunger on eating.
Yes.
It doesn't make sense. But, I mean, the conventional thinking goes like this. You pay people more, and when they have more, they'll want more, and they'll spend more, and that'll increase demand, and then you've got inflation. And also, because of the higher costs of paying them more, inflation.
And maybe that works if you're only in a closed bubble. Right? If you're doing the math in a closed bubble, but the world is no longer a closed bubble because the other solution for wage pressure, other than letting people who already live here into the economy, is immigration.
Yeah.
So wage pressure should never be the issue around which we are getting all worked up and lighting our hair on fire. And let me go and quote from Bill Mitchell, MMT economist Bill Mitchell's Billy blog, about what is inflation, because I think we all think we know what it is, and we don't actually know what it is. So this is a quote from his Billy blog. First, we should make sure what we are talking about. Many conservative commentators think that when workers get a pay rise, that's inflation. It is not. Those on the left think that when the corporate sector increases the price of a good or service, it is inflation. It is not. It is also not inflation when the exchange rate falls, pushing the price of imports up a step. So a depreciation in the currency does not constitute inflation. It might stimulate inflation, but it is not in itself inflation. Let me say that again. It might stimulate inflation, but it is not in and of itself inflation. It is also not inflation when the government increases a particular tax, say the VAT or the GST, by X percent to some new level. So while a price rise is a necessary condition for inflation, it is not a sufficient condition. Observing a price rise alone will not be sufficient to categorize the phenomenon that you are observing as being an inflationary episode. Inflation is the continuous rise in the price level. That is, the price level has to be rising each period that you observe it. So if the price level or a wage level rises by 10% every month, then you have an inflationary episode. In this case, the inflation rate would be considered stable, a consistent rise per period. If the price level was rising by 10% in 1 month, 11% in month two, and then 12% in month three, and so on, you have accelerating inflation. Alternatively, if the price level was rising by 10% in 1 month, 9% in month two, then you have falling or decelerating inflation. So a price rise can become inflation, but it is not necessarily inflation. Many commentators and economists get this basic understanding wrong often and continually. Second, it also follows that cyclical adjustments in price levels by firms from what they were currently offering at depressed levels of activity to what the price levels are defined at their normal operating capacity levels are not inflation. And I'll just jump in here for a minute and say what he's saying is when companies have had to put their inventory on sale in order to continue to be able to sell product and move product, and when they rise it back up to what would be a normal level, that's not inflation. That's just a sale going back to a normal level. When the economy is in poor shape, firms cut prices in an attempt to increase capacity utilization by temporarily suppressing their profit margins and hence retaining market share. As demand conditions become more favorable, the firms start increasing the prices they offer until they get back to those levels that offer them the desired rate of return at normal capacity utilization. And I know that's a mouthful, but basically he's just saying what I summarized a second ago. And I'll be back next week. I'm going to come back next week to go even deeper into the weeds with the MMT take on inflation and how to use a job guarantee program to leverage both price stability and full employment. But for now, I want you to ask yourself, when did we all descend into the collective madness which says that low levels of inflation are bad? Unemployment has always represented a vastly greater loss to the GDP than the real economy than inflation ever has. In other words, there are some losses to the real economy that are represented by inflation, but it's nowhere close to the lost productivity represented by unemployment or underemployment. And when I say nowhere close, I mean many orders of magnitude different. Reasonable levels of inflation, and this is something you know, but you just don't realize or always hold on to the fact that you know it. Reasonable levels of inflation are an indicator of real economic growth. Steady, low inflation reflects the progress and ambition of a society. Realistic inflation is hopeful. And MMT economist Randall Ray says, inflation is the cost of preserving culture. So this sell-off, this Trump slump, is happening because the economy is being measured and bets are being placed not upon the real economy, but based upon the rentier, financialized economy, so the stock market gamblers don't actually do anything based on reality, right? They're just negotiating with the monsters under the bed. They're not actually reflecting what's really going on in factories and in the lives of the unemployed around the country. There is a bubble right now. So the sell-off is also happening because there's a bubble. It's happening because oil prices are getting squirrely. It's happening because international trade has become less secure because the Trump administration is opting for isolation over internationalism. And don't forget, neoliberals really are disconnected from reality as well as the real economy and truly believe that debt causes inflation. It does not now. It never has, but they believe it. So again, they are fighting with the monster under their bed instead of the reality of what history and facts have proven time and time and time again. This is what I mean when I talk about them being quaking aspens, when I talk about them being involved in, you know, with these imaginary struggles. Neoliberals hold this fear of debt as a fact so close to them that they really do believe it, despite the fact there is no backing data. And in my opinion, and this is just me, I haven't read this anywhere, but in my opinion, I actually think that the other thing that's happening in the stock market is that investors have turned around and suddenly noticed the curl of a giant blue tsunami headed for November. So thank you for joining us today on Hopping Mad, and we're so glad to have you back with us after our hiatus. You can find Will on Twitter at WillMcLeod99. You can find me on Twitter at Arliss Bunny, and you can find the show at I'm Hopping Mad. You can find us on our website at imhoppingmad.com. And we want to thank the folks at Netroots Radio. We'll see you next week.